Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. Today we've gathered, well, quite a stack of fascinating material, research papers, articles, historical accounts, and even some personal notes. And they're all focused on a subject that is, I think, visually stunning and carries just immense cultural weight: Kurdish traditional clothing.
That's right. In Kurdish, it's known as Sil-u-Bergen Kurdi. And as we've been going through these sources, it becomes, well, very clear very quickly that this topic goes far beyond just, you know, the practical function of covering the body.
Absolutely. It really does. So our purpose in looking through all this material for you, our listener, is to pull out the most important nuggets, the key insights. Think of it maybe as your shortcut to understanding the significance of this clothing, why it's such a powerful cultural force. We want to uncover some perhaps surprising facts along the way and really highlight just how central it is to Kurdish identity.
And if you're someone who's curious about how culture gets embodied or how history is, well, quite literally worn on your sleeve, or maybe you just appreciate discovering rich and vibrant visual languages from different parts of the world, we really believe you'll find this exploration compelling. We're aiming to give you those aha moments, you know, giving you a solid grasp without feeling completely overwhelmed by every single detail.
Okay, so let's start where the sources seem to begin, which is by establishing that Sil-u-Bergen Kurdi is profoundly more than just everyday wear. It's presented, really throughout the material, as a vibrant, visually striking, and incredibly significant manifestation of Kurdish identity, heritage, and deep cultural pride. It's not just utilitarian dress for function. The sources frame it much more as symbolic art.
That distinction is absolutely crucial. The sources describe these garments as functioning almost like a rich visual lexicon, like a kind of language spoken through fabric, color, design.
A language. What kinds of things does this language communicate?
Well, it conveys really intricate details about who you are, your sense of belonging within the broader community. It shares historical narratives, and it even reflects deeply ingrained social values and aesthetics. Mm. It's a really powerful form of nonverbal communication about identity, about place.
And one of the most powerful ways it does this, apparently, is through its incredible regional diversity. As you look through the material, you just see this vast array of styles, colors, embellishments. They vary dramatically across the different geographical areas of Kurdistan. It's almost like the clothing itself acts as a kind of cultural map.
That's a great way to put it, a cultural map. And this diversity isn't random. It directly reflects the varied geography, you know, from the high mountains down to the valleys and plains. Mm-hmm. It reflects distinct tribal affiliations, unique local customs that have developed over centuries in these different areas. Actually, one source makes the rather striking claim that historically, someone familiar with the attire could often tell which specific region a Kurd came from just by observing their traditional dress.
Wow. Just by looking.
Just by looking. Think about that level of localized identity embedded right there in the clothing.
And beyond just marking that regional identity, the act of wearing traditional dress is also highlighted in the sources as a powerful force for unifying the Kurdish community as a whole. So even with all those regional variations, when people wear these garments, especially during significant cultural celebrations like Nowruz, the Kurdish New Year, or at big gatherings, it reinforces a shared cultural bond.
Yes, and this becomes particularly poignant, I think, within the global Kurdish diaspora. The sources point out that for Kurds living outside their ancestral lands, or crucially, in places where expressing Kurdish identity has historically faced suppression or even outright prohibition, well, wearing traditional clothing transforms into something else. It becomes a very conscious and powerful, almost you could say performative assertion of identity and resilience.
It's a very public act of cultural preservation then, isn't it? It's not just about looking traditional. It's an act of participation in keeping the culture alive, keeping it visible. And the sources do note a noticeable resurgence, a renewed interest and pride in wearing these attires among Kurdish communities globally, especially during these key cultural events, which really speaks volumes about their enduring significance.
Mm-hmm. And moving from that contemporary cultural significance, the sources also carefully trace the historical trajectory of Kurdish clothing. They show its deep roots, really intertwined with the ancient past of the Kurdish people and their ancestral lands.
Yeah, we are talking ancient history here. The material suggests some really fascinating connections, potential influences even, from the attire of the Median and Achaemenid empires which controlled parts of these lands millennia ago.
This is where you start to see that potential for deep historical continuity. The distinctive Median hat, for instance, known as the Kumeh Medan, is frequently discussed in the sources as a possible ancient precursor. Some researchers believe its form and perhaps its significance may have carried through history and influenced the design of certain types of modern Kurdish headwear.
And it's not just archaeological hints, right? We have early written records, too. One of the earliest explicit mentions we find of Kurds having a specific recognizable mode of dress comes from the 13th century historian Ibn Kalakan. He specifically noted that Kurds wore clothing made of cotton and a particular type of head covering, which he called a mandel hat.
Right. And adding another layer to this history, we also have visual evidence from much earlier periods. Historical depictions found on ancient inscriptions in writings that predate Ibn Kalakan, they portray individuals in what are described as distinctly Kurdish garments. For example, you have the Kamenid era images showing Median soldiers, even commanders, wearing attire that many scholars consider ancestral to later Kurdish styles. That suggests a visual lineage stretching back centuries before those detailed written accounts.
And some researchers, based on interpreting these ancient links, they even propose that the historical connection of Kurdish clothing traditions could be traced as far back as, what, 4,000 years?
That's the claim in one source, yes, 4,000 years. If that's accurate, it implies an incredibly long period of cultural continuity and memory embedded within these clothing practices.
But while those ancient roots are clearly significant, the sources also make it clear that Kurdish clothing hasn't just been frozen in time, has it? Throughout its long history, it seems to have undergone a pretty dynamic process of evolution and adaptation.
Exactly. So it's a story of changes, but also of continuity. Earlier forms might have been more elaborate, perhaps different in construction. We don't always know for sure. But the clothing has evolved into forms that are, well, arguably simpler in some ways today, yet still very, very distinctive. The sources point to shifts happening particularly after the Qajar and Ottoman periods. These periods saw significant economic changes and, importantly, an expansion in the variety of available fabrics due to increased trade.
Yet, despite these changes, you know, the introduction of new materials, external influences, the clothing has, as the sources put it, remarkably retained its authenticity. It continues to be viewed and valued by Kurdish people as a powerful symbol of their distinct identity and, interestingly, their sovereign history, a reminder of a past where they perhaps had greater autonomy.
And geography has undeniably played a massive role in shaping this evolution and adaptation. The sources really highlight how the unique and often challenging mountainous terrain and the cold climates of regions like the Zagros Mountains profoundly influenced design choices, prioritizing practicality right alongside aesthetics.
Is there a specific example of that?
Yes. A very clear one is the shalpisht. That's the substantial sash or waistband worn by men. The sources directly link its widespread adoption and its, well, substantial nature to the challenging Zagros geography. It underscores its functional importance. It provided warmth, crucial support for the back during physical labor, and it served as a handy place to tuck necessary items. It's a piece of clothing quite literally shaped by the environment.
And the materials themselves tell a story too, don't they? A story of historical trade, economic shifts across the region.
Absolutely. Traditionally, there was a strong reliance on local materials, things like sheep wool and goat leather. This reflects the pastoral and agricultural lifestyles that were prevalent in many Kurdish communities. The sources note this as the foundational material palette.
And then from those local origins.
Well, from there, we see a gradual shift towards incorporating a broader array of imported fabrics. Luxurious materials like silk, velvet, brocade, they became more common, especially after the Qajar and Ottoman periods, at least for those who could afford them. And later, more accessible materials like synthetics also entered the mix. This transition clearly signals increasing interaction with broader regional and global trade networks and the evolving economic landscape within Kurdistan itself. The sources even mention the historical introduction of specific items, like a Meccan scarf or the Sadamazera dress, which apparently had Arab stylistic influences, demonstrating that incorporation of external elements through trade.
Okay, so bringing these threads together, the sources really position Kurdish traditional clothing as a crucial cultural pillar. It serves, undeniably and powerfully, as a symbol of national identity, something that visually distinguishes Kurds from neighboring populations.
And it's not just a visual marker. It's considered absolutely fundamental to the culture. The sources state that its importance is seen as equivalent to other cornerstones of Kurdish culture, like the Kurdish language itself, or deeply held traditional customs and social norms. It holds that much weight.
And you see the significance most vividly displayed during festivals and special occasions, right? These garments are donned with particular pride and meaning during major events like Newroz, weddings, large communal gatherings. It's the attire of celebration. It symbolizes cultural continuity, collective joy, a very visible expression of shared heritage.
Mm-hmm. Historically, there was also that connection between attire and social status, although the sources are careful to note this is less universally prevalent in all areas today.
Yeah.
But traditionally, the quality and just the sheer quantity of jewelry adorning a woman, which was often an intricate and integrated part of her traditional clothing ensemble, could visibly indicate her family's wealth or societal standing.
So this whole story, the evolution, the continued significance, often against external pressures, it points to what the sources describe as dynamic continuity.
Exactly. While the clothing has adapted over time, incorporating new materials, undergoing changes in form, responding to practical needs, or even external styles, the core elements, the practical considerations embedded in the design, and that profound symbolic value have been fiercely preserved.
And this preservation often happened deliberately, didn't it? Sometimes in the face of significant political pressures or attempts at cultural assimilation.
Yes, the resilience of these clothing traditions really suggests a conscious collective effort within the community to maintain cultural boundaries, to resist external pressures, and to visually assert their identity in historical narratives through this enduring medium of dress.
Now, let's circle back to that idea of the clothing as a visual lexicon, and specifically as a regional map, because the sources make it abundantly clear that this regional diversity isn't just some minor point. It is, in fact, a defining characteristic of Sil'u Birjin Kurdi. This specificity genuinely allows for someone knowledgeable, as you said, to identify an individual's likely specific area of origin within the broader geography of Kurdistan.
And this incredible variation, as we touched on earlier, it isn't accidental. It's the rich product of that complex interplay between the local geography and climate of a specific area, distinct tribal customs that evolved in different valleys or plains, and historical interactions with neighboring cultures and trading partners. All these factors combine to create these unique local styles.
And it's perhaps most intricately expressed in women's attire. The sources mention specific outfits named after cities.
That's right. Women's outfits are frequently named directly after cities or regions within Kurdistan. You hear about Mahabadi dresses, Suleimani dresses, Hallery dresses. This naming convention itself reinforces the idea that the clothing acts as what one source beautifully termed a living, wearable map of Kurdish cultural geography.
A living, wearable map. I like that.
It's evocative, isn't it? And that level of differentiation where a style becomes synonymous with a place name, it strongly suggests the historical presence of deep-seated, localized craft traditions. It also points to a conscious effort, perhaps historically driven by limited travel or maybe a desire to maintain distinct local identities, to preserve and differentiate these styles. It wasn't just that styles happened to be different. They were recognized, named, and maintained as distinct markers of belonging.
Okay, to give you, our listener, a better sense of this visual mosaic, let's try and delve into some specific regional styles. Starting with men's clothing, although the sources seem to offer maybe a bit more detail on women's attire overall. So in northern Kurdistan, for instance, the style is often characterized as relatively more tight-fitting compared to central styles, sometimes bearing resemblances, the sources say, to rural Turkish or Balkan costumes in neighboring areas.
Mm-hmm. Men's trousers in the north typically feature a combination of tight lower legs and a looser, more baggy crotch section, offering freedom of movement where needed. Neck scarves and waistcoats worn over shirts are common elements. Headgear varies, often including loosely weaned turbans or simple skull caps, depending on the local tradition.
Okay, then moving towards central Kurdistan, the Sorani-speaking regions, here we encounter the widely recognized and often quite striking Shalu Shapik ensemble for men.
Ah, yes, the Shalu Shapik. This is a very distinct two-piece suit. It includes a fitted collarless jacket, usually open to the waist, and designed to be tucked into the trousers. The trousers themselves are quite notable. They feature a gathered waist, but then flare out distinctively at the ankle. The suit is often made of a specific striped fabric, commonly in brown, cream, or gray pinstripes. Or it can be a solid color, but feature intricate embroidery, particularly on the jacket and trousers.
And underneath the jacket.
Underneath, men wear a white shirt, known as a cross. In the central style, this is characterized by prominent, often wide, funnel sleeves. These sleeves are traditionally styled by being wound around the outside of the jacket arms, creating a very distinctive look. And a substantial sash or belt, the pishtun or shawl, is also a key component, Men's headwear in this region typically involves a turban carefully coiled around a skullcap base.
Right. Then further south, the style prevalent in southern Kurdistan. This has gained broader recognition, partly due to its association with the Peshmerga forces who adopted a version as a standard uniform.
That's correct. This style features baggy trousers, similar to other regions, but specifically gathered at the waist and then tapering at the ankle that contrasts with the Sorani style's flair.
And the jacket.
The jacket is often similar in cut to the central style, but tends to lack the elaborate embroidery you see on the Shalu Shapik. These suits are commonly made in solid colors or perhaps subtle pinstripes. A sash is worn, its length and width varying, and headwear often includes a skull cap combined with a large fringed square scarf wrapped as a turban.
The Mukriani region in Iranian Kurdistan also has specific styles mentioned.
Yes, although the sources provide much more detail on women's Mukriani dress, one source does mention that men in the Mukrian Rawanduz areas traditionally wear smaller turbans, often featuring fringes.
And certain garments seem strongly associated with specific smaller regions, yeah, like the Farangi vest.
Exactly. The Farangi is a distinctive felted wool vest, characteristic of Harami men's attire. The sources highlight its ingenious design, noting its ability to provide warmth in cold mountain winters, while also offering a cooling effect in summer through ventilation. Quite clever.
It sounds it. The sources do imply other regional variations exist for men, too, across East Anatolia and other parts of Kurdistan, beyond those specifically detailed. Like the Amuda region's Peshim and Pirkez ensemble jacket and trousers of the same color, cut broadly and loosely, perhaps for ease of movement.
Yes, it's clearly a very rich and varied picture, even just for men's attire.
Okay, shifting gears now to women's regional styles. This seems to be where the clothing often reaches its peak of vibrancy, intricacy, and layering.
Absolutely. Central Kurdistan, again, is well represented in the sources, known for its iconic Sorani dress, which is widely considered the archetypal Kurdish women's attire by many.
So what defines the style?
Well, this widely worn style is built around layers. It includes inner trousers, the darpe or sharwal, and often a plain underdress or petticoat worn beneath the centerpiece. The floor-length dress, the kiras. This dress is typically made from light, often sheer or diaphanous fabrics.
And it has those distinctive sleeves, right? The fakiana.
Exactly. That's a defining and immediately recognizable feature of the kiras. The long, often dramatically funnel-shaped or triangular sleeves. And over this base dress, women layer various outer garments, depending on the occasion and personal preference.
What kind of outer layers?
These can include a short waistcoat, referred to as a salta, hilak, or sukma, or a long coat or robe, known as a kawa or siftan. Sometimes there might also be a shorter jacket. Traditional materials for the dress include light fabrics like chiffon voile, silk, or fine cotton, while richer fabrics like velvets, brocades, and sometimes satins are favored for the more structured outerwear components.
Okay. And the Mukriani costume for women, particularly around Mahabad and Sakwiz in Iranian Kurdistan, that's noted as being particularly distinct.
Very distinct, yes. It features trousers that are significantly more voluminous compared to many other styles, often worn without a separate cotton top part.
And the layering is different, too.
Slightly, yes. Women wear a short vest top, maybe a sukma, under a sheer dress. But this dress features straight, rather than flared, sleeves, and it's gathered higher, at the hips, unlike the central style's flowing line. A large sash is characteristically worn quite low on the hips, adding to the silhouette. This is then complemented by a waist-length coat.
And the headgear in the Mukriani style sounds quite elaborate, too.
It is. It traditionally includes a decorated velvet or brocade pillbox hat as a base. This is topped with a large triangular shawl, likely the dazmal or maybe the sharuk we'll discuss later, which is crossed over the chest with the ends hanging down the back. Detailed accounts highlight substyles like Sablakian and Mangroyati, noting loose-fitting designs influenced by regional Islamic dress traditions, and a preference for colors that vividly reflect nature, often named using terms like the eyes of partridge or pomegranate flowers. Really poetic descriptions.
Wow. Okay, what about the Badinani or Hakkari style? That's found more in northern Iraqi Kurdistan and neighboring parts of Turkey.
Right. Women's attire here also features layers, customary trousers, and a plain underdress or petticoat that is typically above knee length. This is worn under a sheer dress with a gathered waist and flowing funnel sleeves, similar in principle to the Sorani style, but with distinct layering elements.
Such as
a long-sleeve coat with a wide scooped front fastening at the waist, which is worn over this sheer dress. Notably, the style often includes a wide gathered skirt worn over the dress, but under the coat, which doesn't meet at the front, exposing the underlying layers. The sheer dress is seldom worn without this coat, and the long sleeves of the dress are often functionally tied behind the back to keep them out of the way.
Interesting. An East Anatolian women's dress.
The sources describe baggy trousers worn under a knee-length dress, often layered with aprons, and utilizing a variety of colors. The trouser construction is specific, often featuring a cotton top part lined with cotton and gathered tightly at the ankle. A sash is worn, along with a short jacket, and sometimes a long coat.
And the sources also point out influences from neighboring cultures and some regional styles, like Arab influences.
Yes, for instance, elements of the Arab abaya are seen in parts of Western Kurdistan, and discernible Arab stylistic influences are noted in the women's dress of Sulaymaniyya. And this is important to note because it shows cultural exchange isn't just a one-way street.
Right. It's not portrayed as wholesale adoption replacing Kurdish identity.
Exactly. It's presented more as a selective incorporation or adaptation of certain elements from neighbors woven into existing Kurdish frameworks. It illustrates a nuanced and dynamic process of cultural exchange while still maintaining a core sense of Kurdish self-definition through clothing.
Okay, let's delve a bit deeper now into the specific garments that form these complex ensembles, starting again with men's traditional attire. The sources consistently emphasize practicality, right? Even if they look complex.
Yes, practicality is a recurring theme. While perhaps appearing simpler than women's attire at first glance, men's clothing is quite complex and highly practical. It reflects the need for freedom of movement in activities ranging from daily work and farming to ceremony. Suitability for the terrain and climate adaptation were definitely key drivers of the design.
Okay, so let's look at the core pieces. First, the sharwal or pantal, the trousers.
Right, the loose, baggy trousers that taper to the ankles. And as we mentioned, you see those regional variations in the cut. The northern style with tight lower legs, the central Serrani style with that distinctive flare at the ankle, and the southern style tapering more directly. These are all adaptations of the same fundamental garment shape, tailored for regional needs or aesthetics.
And for the upper body, there are various terms like kurtak, kawa, choka.
Yes, and others like dekun, Serrani, and Raksani are mentioned too. These refer generally to jackets or coats worn over a shirt. The kurtak can be a matching jacket worn with sharwal as a set. Kawa is a more general term for a coat. Choka is specifically the jacket part of the rank uchogal outfit. In the Shalu Shepik ensemble, it's that specific fitted collarless jacket. These garments provide layers for warmth and protection.
And the kras is the shirt underneath.
Correct. The kras is the shirt worn underneath the jacket or vest. Typically, it's a plain, often white shirt. And as we noted, the central Serrani style is famous for its white kras, with those characteristically wide funnel-shaped sleeves that are then styled by wrapping them around the jacket arms.
And that sash element seems really significant, the pishtun, shawl, or sash.
Oh, absolutely. A really significant and visually prominent element. It's the substantial belt or waistband wrapped around the waist. And it goes by many regional names, pishtun, firstun, shalpisht, kimar, pestan, shela, shalema, shut. Lots of terms.
And it's not just decorative.
Not at all. These sashes can be quite substantial and require specific techniques to tie them securely and elaborately. Beyond their aesthetic role, they traditionally served a very practical purpose, acting as a kind of utility belt where men could tuck various items, from tools to, historically, weapons. The shalpisht in particular is explicitly linked in the sources to the demands of the Zagros Mountain geography, providing that crucial lumbar support and warmth in a challenging environment.
The sources also list several specific named ensembles, right? Like rank uchogal.
Yes, representing distinct, recognized combinations of these core garments that create a particular look. Rank uchogal is cited as the main traditional dress. Kurtak usharwal refers to a simple matching jacket and trousers set. And of course, shalsu shapik is the well-known central Kurdish style.
And there are others mentioned too.
Indeed. Other named outfits mentioned include starzani, katafa, miradzani, bedini, and harami, suggesting further layers of regional or historical specificity captured in these names. And as we noted earlier, peshim and pirkez are the terms for that specific jacket and trousers combination worn in the Amuda region.
Okay. So beyond the main garments, men's attire is completed by a diverse array of headwear, specific footwear, and various accessories and outerwear, each carrying cultural meaning and often reflecting regional identity.
Headwear is particularly varied. The jamana, jamadani, or pushi refers to a headkerchief or patterned fabric cover. The color and the specific way it's tied can often signal a wearer's region or even tribal affiliation. For example, the Barzani tribe is often associated with a specific red-checked kufia pattern. And Yazidi men have a tradition of wearing a similar pattern but tied inside out. Interesting detail.
It is. And the claw, the skull cap.
That's a fundamental piece, often worn alone as simple head covering or serving as the base layer around which a turban is wound. Klamishki is noted as a specific type of skull cap.
And the turban itself varies a lot.
Hugely. Cloth wrapped around a skull cap or fez. It comes in many forms and styles that vary significantly by region. Turkish Kurds are noted for wearing extra-large turbans, while men in the Mukri and Rwandu's areas might wear smaller ones with fringes. And that early historical mention of the mandel hat by Ibn Khalikan was essentially an early form of turban or wrapped head covering.
What about the fez?
The fez, or tarbush, has also been historically used in some areas, sometimes as a standalone hat, but often serving as the base around which a turban was wrapped, providing structure.
And footwear. The clash or givas sound iconic.
They are. Distinctive white cloth shoes, often handmade, known for their breathability and suitability for mountain terrain. Worsted shoes are also documented as a traditional type of footwear.
And accessories and outerwear add further layers, like that Ferengi vest again.
Yes, the Ferengi pastak or kula ball, that felted wool vest, characteristic of Harami attire, highly valued for its unique ability to regulate body temperature in varying conditions. A sleeveless, thick felt waistcoat is also typical in the southern style.
And puzawana.
Wool leg warmers, providing crucial warmth in colder climates. Historically, and perhaps more for ceremonial or status purposes now, daggers or swords were often tucked into the sash, signifying the wearer's status or readiness.
There's also the yelek.
A sleeveless vest that can be worn under or over a jacket, or sometimes in place of one, adding an extra layer. In Western Kurdistan, influenced by neighboring Arab styles, men might wear long robes like the zuban, sometimes incorporating elements or wearing a full abaya alongside traditional Kurdish elements. And shepherds and farmers also historically wore practical outerwear like sheepskin or large felt coats for protection against the elements.
And materials and colors for men, generally more subdued.
Generally, yes. The tradition began with local sheep wool and goat leather, chosen for durability, suitability for pastoral life, climate protection. Over time, materials like linen and baize were also incorporated. The color palette is generally more subdued compared to women's clothing, favoring earthy and practical tones like black, gray, brown, white, and blue. The exceptions, like the striped browns and creams of the shell ushupik, really stand out against this general tendency.
Okay, now let's step into the vibrant world of women's traditional attire, which the sources consistently describe as being renowned for its incredible vibrancy, intricate embellishments, and complex layering. It really seems like a powerful and visible expression of cultural identity, regional diversity, and a primary canvas for artistry.
Absolutely. That elaborate nature, the multiple layers, the richness of the fabrics, the dazzling array of colors, and the sheer quantity of jewelry. It suggests that historically, and still today, it functions as a prominent way to display not just artistry, but also, for those who could afford it, wealth and social status.
And the absolute centerpiece of the women's ensemble is the kiraz, right? The jili kurdi, the long dress.
That's the one. The long flowing dress that typically reaches the floor. These dresses are traditionally crafted from light, often sheer or diaphanous fabrics like chiffon voile, silk, or fine cotton, creating a graceful, layered look. And a defining feature, as we mentioned, are those long, often dramatically funnel-shaped or triangular sleeves, known specifically as fekiana.
And these sleeves can be exceptionally long.
Oh, yes, sometimes trailing significantly. And they are often styled dynamically tied behind the back, wrapped intricately around the arms. The kiraz itself is usually heavily adorned, particularly around the neckline, sleeves, and hem, with elaborate embroidery, sequins, beads, sometimes metallic pieces, adding significant weight and sparkle.
And worn over the kiraz are various outerwear garments, like the chiftan or kawar.
Exactly. These complete the layered look. The chiftan, also known as kaftan or kawa, is a significant outer piece, often a long flowing coat or robe. These terms seem to be used somewhat interchangeably across regions and sources.
And the chiftan is a key component for special occasions.
Yes, definitely. Worn over the kiraz for special occasions. They are typically made from luxurious, often heavy fabrics like velvet, brocade, or silk. And they are frequently heavily embroidered, sequined, or otherwise richly embellished, making them visually stunning garments. Those descriptions of the long coats worn in the Sirani and Badinani styles are likely referring to regional forms of the chiftan or kawa. It's interesting that online retailers also commonly use terms like seftan or kaftan for this type of outer robe, indicating its recognition beyond just academic sources.
And besides the long coats, shorter outerwear is common too. Salta, hilak, sukma.
Yes. Those terms refer to a short jacket or a vest, which can be sleeveless or have sleeves. It's frequently worn over the kiras, often complementing the outer coat, or perhaps worn instead of it in warmer weather. These two are often made from rich materials like velvet or brocade and can be highly decorated.
And underneath the kiras, trousers and undergarments.
Right. Underneath, darp or sharwal, baggy trousers or bloomers are worn. These serve a purpose of modesty and add to the layered silhouette. And as noted, women in the Mukrian region are particularly known for wearing notably voluminous trousers as part of their ensemble. And a zerkras, or a simple petticoat or underdress, is often worn beneath the sheer kiras for opacity and to provide a smooth base layer for the more decorative elements.
Okay, let's zero in on some truly distinctive features of women's attire. Their headwear, the integral role of jewelry, and even some practical adaptations. Those fakana sleeves really are a hallmark, aren't they?
Absolutely. The long, often triangular or funnel-shaped sleeve endings are a defining feature across many styles of the kiras. They are frequently the site of intense embellishment and artistry, and as you highlighted, the way they are styled, tied behind the back, wrapped, or left flowing, is part of the visual language of the dress.
And shawls and cloths play various roles. Dazmal, shawl.
Yes. A dazmal is often described as a triangular piece of fabric, sometimes sheer, thrown over the shoulders. In the specific Mukriani style, a large triangular shawl, likely this dazmal, or perhaps the shorouk we'll get to, is a significant part of the elaborate headwear ensemble. Shawl is mentioned as a general term for a multi-purpose cloth worn over the shoulders. Kulwana, or kulwana, is described as a type of cape. And charukia is specifically mentioned in historical accounts as a kind of heavy cloth, traditionally thrown over one shoulder by Mukri women, perhaps related to that large shawl in the Mukriani headwear, or a separate garment altogether.
And a sash or belt is also worn, shtend or shten.
Yes, typically around the waist, or as seen in the Mukriani style, lower on the hips. These can be made of fabric, or for more affluent women, often elaborate metal belts, sometimes made of gold or silver, are worn.
Women's headwear seems incredibly varied and regionally specific.
Perhaps the most varied element. The claw or hat takes countless forms. Simple skull caps, decorated velvet caps, that distinctive pillbox hat in the Mukriani style, and historically, fezzes in some areas. These hats are often heavily embellished themselves, adorned with coins, beads, chains, small pieces of jewelry, or intricate embroidery.
And scarves are integral too.
Very much so. Used in many ways as long, sheer scarves draped over the skull cap, or multiple layered scarves meticulously arranged to form impressive, tall turbans in certain regional styles. Mukri and Sina women, for instance, are known for wearing particularly large and visually striking turbans. While historically common, that very traditional backcloth and headdress ensemble, including a velvet skullcap and very tall layered turban, is now mostly seen on elderly women, apparently, as acquiring all the components can be difficult these days.
And jewelry isn't just an accessory, it's described as integral?
Absolutely integral, and often quite extravagant, forming a crucial part of the traditional ensemble. The sources list a dazzling array: necklaces, muanka, bracelets, bozens, earrings, guara, rings, mistila, and ankle bracelets.
And beyond those standard types.
Numerous decorative coins, pearls, even cloves, Meksek lir, incorporated into the garments or headwear, and other traditional ornaments like gobarok, sirchana, shutin, referring to a decorative belt in this context, nochawan, a forehead ornament, and ashipend. And as we mentioned, elaborate gold belts were a clear indicator of affluence for women, reinforcing that historical link between jewelry and status.
But it's important to note, despite all this focus on vibrancy and embellishment, women's attire also incorporated practical adaptations. You mentioned the Ottoman dress.
Yes, that's a great example. The Ottoman dress, considered one of the oldest styles and notable for its functionality. Its skirt could be skillfully pulled up and tucked into the skwen, the waist shawl, to facilitate movement and make daily chores, farming or harvesting, easier. This shows that practicality was considered, much like in men's clothing, even within the most decorative ensembles.
We mentioned specific regional styles named after cities earlier, Mahabadi, Sulaimani, Halari. The Ottoman dress is highlighted as one of the oldest, noted for its functionality. The Bilbasi dress is another old style, though less common now, recognized for its notably loose cut and exceptionally long sleeves. These names and features really underline the detailed tapestry of regional identity.
They do. And for women's attire, the materials are incredibly diverse. Chiffon voile, cotton, velvet, brocade, silk, satin, various sheer fabrics forming the layers. For contemporary festive wear, vibrant synthetic fabrics and sequins are widely popular, adding maximum sparkle. The color palette is overwhelmingly vibrant and diverse, featuring nearly every color imaginable, often said to reflect the beauty of the landscapes and the spirit of the people. While older women might sometimes favor darker tones, younger women typically gravitate towards bright, saturated colors for celebration.
Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roach Bosch, Hannah.
Roach Bosch, Hannah. Perfect timing.
Let's get some chai. Always look forward to this part. What have you got for us today? Smells good.
It does smell good. Maybe a slightly different blend today.
It sips. Oh, interesting. It's got a really strong note today. A little bit on the bitter side for me, perhaps. Maybe could use just a touch more sugar.
You know, I think you might be right. It's good. It's warming. But yeah, maybe just that little bit of sweetness to balance it out properly. Still, very welcome. Perfect for keeping us focused on all these intricate details.
Definitely. All right. That's better with a bit more sugar. Okay. Back to the threads and the stories they tell.
Indeed. As we look closer at the materials, colors, and the artistry involved, it's clear these elements are deeply intertwined with the environment, historical trade routes, and profound symbolism.
The fabrics themselves seem to tell stories, don't they? Stories of the land and the people's history. Traditional foundations, as we discussed, were local sheep wool and goat leather, reflecting that pastoral lifestyle and the necessity of climate protection in mountainous regions. Cotton was also an early and significant material.
Then came the introduction of more luxurious imported textiles. Silk, velvet, and brocade gained significant prominence, particularly for creating women's more elaborate garments and outerwear. Symbolizing, perhaps, increased prosperity and access to trade networks, especially after the Qajar and Ottoman periods.
And more modern fabrics?
More modern fabrics like chiffon, voile, and satin are now staples for women's dresses and coats. Contemporary festive attire, particularly for younger generations, frequently incorporates synthetics and a dazzling array of sequins for maximum visual impact. And as we noted, durable tergal fabric is often used for children's clothing.
What's particularly evocative are those names given to some of the fabrics in Kurdish. That sounds fascinating.
It really is. The sources detail a rich vocabulary drawing directly from nature names like the eyes of partridge, spotted mountain, frost, pomegranate flowers, and apple flowers. This isn't just descriptive. It suggests a deep, intimate ecological connection. These artisans weren't just working with material. They were interpreting their natural world and embedding that relationship directly into the language of their craft. It's quite beautiful.
It is. And color symbolism is also a powerful layer of meaning woven into the clothing.
Absolutely. Generally, as we've seen, women's attire features a palette of vibrant, often pure colors, said to reflect the beauty of the landscapes and the joyful spirit, while men's attire tends to be more subdued, reflecting practicality.
But specific colors carry specific connotations.
Yes, specific historical or social connotations. Green, for instance, can signify descent from the Hashemites, particularly associated with side women. Red is strongly associated with brides and celebrations. Historically, specific red lace robes were worn by virgin brides, earning the term red bride.
And white.
White lace was traditionally used for widows at their weddings, which is a poignant detail. And white scarves are characteristic head coverings for mullahs' wives. Blue, while beautiful, is sometimes associated with sadness or mourning in certain contexts. And the vibrant, pure colors of traditional Nuraz attire are specifically chosen to symbolize joy, renewal, and celebration.
Motifs add another layer of symbolic depth. The bote, or paisley motif, sounds prevalent.
Highly prevalent, yes, in Kurdish textiles and rugs. While its origins are ancient and widespread across the region, in Kurdish contexts, interpretations vary. It can symbolize life, eternity, fertility, or represent a leaf, a flame, or even a pine cone.
And its origins might link back to ancient beliefs.
The sources note its ancient Persian origins and suggest a possible link to Zoroastrian symbols, such as the eternal flame or the sacred cypress tree. This potentially connects Kurdish textile art back to very ancient regional belief systems and spiritual concepts.
Floral and vine motifs are also common.
Extremely common, yes, particularly in embroidery styles like Suzani and on women's dresses, reflecting that deep appreciation for and connection to the natural world. Geometric patterns are also characteristic of Kurdish embroidery and woven textiles, showcasing a sophisticated abstract design sense and technical skill.
And the serpent or dragon motif, that sounds intriguing.
It is fascinating, often represented by an S-shaped pattern. In Kurdish folklore, this symbol is associated with luck, abundance, strength, even immortality. It's found on kilims and various textiles, and notably is particularly prevalent among Yazidi communities. This links the clothing directly to widespread folkloric traditions and imbues the garments with protective or auspicious qualities.
And other nature-inspired motifs, sun, moon, stars.
Yes. Celestial bodies like the sun, moon, stars, and animals common in the region are also frequently found in broader Kurdish folk art, including dek, the traditional tattoos. And these influences likely extend to textile design, further emphasizing the connection to the natural and cosmological world. The sources really emphasize this idea that each embroidered stitch and every vibrant color tells a story, imbuing these garments with layers of narrative depth beyond just simple decoration.
Which brings us to the artistry itself, particularly the intricate needlework and embellishments known generally as sukme.
That's the term, yes. Kurdish clothing is renowned for its incredible intricacy and beauty in this regard, a true testament to the skill and artistry, particularly of Kurdish women, who are the primary custodians of these techniques.
And sukme is the general term.
Yes, encompassing needlework and embroidery. Kurdishi embroidery refers to a specific style characterized by its bright colors and bold geometric patterns used to decorate various parts of the garments, dresses, jackets, headscarves. Suzani embroidery, known for its specific floral and vine motifs, is also applied to clothing embellishment.
And the materials used for these embellishments, sequins, beads.
Yes, varied and often luxurious.
Hmm.
Sequins, beads made of glass or pearl, metallic threads, gold or silver, and even intricate tapestry work. The embroidery is strategically concentrated on prominent areas like the chest, sleeves, and shoulders for maximum visual impact. While women's attire is most heavily embellished, men's outfits like the shawl or shapit can also feature embroidery, though typically less extensively.
Okay. As we navigate all these details, this rich visual lexicon, the sources highlight the need to understand specific terminology, noting that there can be regional variations and some flexibility in how terms are used. Two terms that frequently come up, particularly in women's outerwear, are shiftan and shuruk. Let's clarify those.
Good idea. Shiftan, also seen sometimes as kafsan or veftan, is frequently used in descriptions of women's outer garments. It's commonly used interchangeably with kawa, or specifically refers to a type of long coat or robe worn over the kiras.
So it's a significant component of that layered look for special occasions.
Exactly. Typically made from those luxurious decorated fabrics like velvet, brocade, or silk, and heavily embroidered or sequined. Those descriptions of the long outer coats in the Sarani and Badinani styles are likely referring to regional forms of the jiftan or kawa. And as we noted, online vendors often use jeftan or kaftan for these elaborate outer robes, suggesting it's a broadly recognized term.
Okay, and charuk, or charukia.
This term appears in historical descriptions. It's mentioned as a kind of heavy cloth thrown over one shoulder, particularly associated with Mukri women in older accounts. Now, this aligns quite well with the description of the Mukriani women's elaborate headgear, which includes that large triangular shawl worn over a pillbox hat, often crossed over the chest and hanging down the back.
And someone suggested desmal for that shawl.
Yes. A user comment in the material suggested desmal as a term for this specific top shawl portion of the Mukriani headwear ensemble. So, based on the sources, charuk or charukia seems to refer specifically to a substantial shawl or large cloth, particularly associated with the Mukrian region. Used either as a shoulder drape or as a significant component of that very elaborate regional head covering distinct from a simpler headscarf, which might be called a lechik.
Okay, so to summarize the distinction as presented in the sources, jiftan is a broader term, generally referring to an elaborate outer robe or coat worn over the dress, while shuruk seems more specific, referring to a substantial shawl or wrap with a documented role and form, particularly within the Mukrian style.
That seems to be the gist. The sources do acknowledge that there isn't a single rigid universal glossary for all terms across all regions, so context is always key when encountering these names.
Right. Now, looking at Kurdish traditional dress in the 21st century, the sources describe a really complex and dynamic landscape, don't they? It's a story involving cultural resilience, navigating political dynamics, economic pressures, the influence of global fashion trends. It seems to be a continuous process of adaptation, reinterpretation, and importantly, conscious preservation.
Absolutely. The impact of modernization and globalization is certainly noted. The sources report that daily wear of full traditional dress is increasingly disappearing in some contexts, particularly in urban areas or within the diaspora, as people adopt more Western or host country styles for everyday life.
And this decline started some time ago.
Apparently, widespread daily use, which was more common even into the 1970s, has reportedly faded. Due to a combination of factors, including political pressures at different times and increased exposure to the outside world through media and travel. Modernization can also mean that contemporary versions intended for everyday wear might become simplified, diluting or losing some traditional features. One researcher expresses a concern that wearing these significantly modified versions daily doesn't necessarily preserve the authentic historical attributes of the clothing. A valid point to consider.
And the political context has had a profound, undeniable impact.
Profound, yes. In Iran, the requirement for Islamic dress sometimes interacts complexly with traditional Kurdish elements. In Turkey, historical state bans on headscarves in public institutions affected Kurdish women wearing traditional head coverings. Most dramatically, Iraq, under Saddam Hussein, implemented bans on wearing Kurdish dress in certain areas in the 1980s. These instances starkly highlight how potent and politically charged these cultural symbols can be perceived by authorities.
Yet, despite these challenges and the decline in daily use in some areas, there's also a very notable and growing return to traditional culture, as one source puts it.
Yes, a significant resurgence. Many Kurds, even if they don't wear it daily, acquire and wear at least one traditional outfit annually for specific occasions.
And Kurdish Clothes Day, March 10th, seems crucial here.
Absolutely crucial. Established in Iraqi Kurdistan and now celebrated enthusiastically in Kurdish communities elsewhere, including participation reported even among officials in Iranian Kurdistan. It sees widespread participation in schools, offices, public life. It transforms the act of wearing the clothes into a collective public statement of identity and pride, which is particularly significant given that history of prohibitions. It's seen as vital for promoting culture and authenticity globally.
And cultural festivals like Nowruz and weddings remain pivotal.
Absolutely pivotal occasions where traditional dress is worn with pride and is widely visible. The diaspora also plays a significant role, fostering interest both among those living abroad and back home, and contributing to increasing global demand for traditional garments.
And local artisans and dressmakers are vital figures in this.
Absolutely vital figures in this ecosystem of preservation and evolution. They are actively creating new designs, often blending traditional styles and techniques with modern fashion sensibilities. This ensures the clothing remains relevant and appealing, particularly to younger generations. The sources also note an increase in women artisans, which provides livelihoods and further strengthens the promotion and transmission of cultural practices.
And contemporary adaptations show it's a living tradition, like tighter sharwal.
Exactly. It's not static. Younger men, for example, might prefer their sharwal trousers cut with a slightly tighter fit than traditional styles. Designers are often inspired by older styles, perhaps from the 70s or 80s, but utilize new fabrics, cuts, and embellishments. For special occasion wear, like engagement dresses, there's a strong focus on higher quality fabrics, like silk and lace, and incredibly elaborate handwork and embellishments.
There's even a mention of sustainability.
Yes, a growing awareness noted in the sources regarding the sustainable care of these garments. Recommendations like airing them, rather than frequent washing, to preserve their delicate materials for future generations and reduce environmental impact, linking tradition to modern values.
So this section really highlights these concurrent trends. A decrease in everyday wear in some contexts versus a powerful resurgence for special occasions and cultural days, often with contemporary adaptations.
Precisely. It signals a shift in the primary role of traditional dress, perhaps, from everyday apparel to a more symbolic and ceremonial one, but one that is fiercely protected, celebrated, and creatively reinterpreted.
Okay. Bringing all these threads together now, our exploration, based on the sources you provided, reveals that Kurdish traditional attire, Silu Birgen Kurdi, is far, far more than just fabric and thread. It is a dynamic, deeply significant, and enduring emblem of Kurdish cultural identity, history, regional diversity, and incredible artistic expression.
It is, as the source is so clearly articulate, a living visual language, a language that tells the story of the Kurdish people, their profound connection to the land, their social structures, their aesthetic values, and the remarkable resilience in the face of historical challenges.
We've traced its journey from antiquity, with those potential echoes of the Medes and Achaemenids, through centuries of evolution and adaptation, always seeming to maintain its core essence. It's a tradition shaped intimately by geography, climate, tribal affiliations, and interactions with neighbors.
The incredible regional variations create that rich, wearable mosaic of local identities across Kurdistan. The materials used reflect shifting economics and trade, and the symbolism embedded in colors and motifs links back to ancient beliefs, folklore, and that deep connection to the natural world.
And the artistry, particularly the sukma embroidery and embellishments, showcases immense skill and craftsmanship. acknowledging the primary role of Kurdish women not only as wearers, but as the crucial custodians and innovators of these traditions.
In the 21st century, it continues to navigate the complexities of modernization, globalization, and political pressures. While its role in daily life may have diminished in some areas, its powerful symbolic and ceremonial resurgence, particularly evident on Kurdish Clothes Day and at Newroz, ensures it remains a vibrant, living tradition, capable of reinterpretation and continuous expression.
Ultimately, Kurdish traditional clothing is just a vibrant testament to the enduring spirit and cultural richness of the Kurdish people. It continues to speak eloquently, visibly, and powerfully of identity, belonging, and the unbreakable bond between a people and their heritage.
And as we conclude this look at the sources on Sulu Bergen Kurdi, it leaves us perhaps with a compelling question to consider. Something for you, our listener, to think about. Given the pressures of modernization, the rise of global fashion, and the emergence of contemporary versions that are inspired by traditional styles but aren't strict replicas, how do cultures like the Kurdish people balance that crucial importance of preserving what's considered the authentic tradition, with the equally important need, perhaps, to allow that tradition to evolve and adapt so it remains relevant, accessible, and appealing to younger generations, ensuring its continuity into the future?
A truly thought-provoking question to end on. Thank you for joining us for this exploration drawn from the stacked sources you provided, which gave us this focused look into the rich world of Kurdish traditional clothing.
It's been a privilege to help unpack the visual stories these beautiful garments tell and the layers of deep meaning embedded within this incredible cultural attire.
Absolutely. We encourage you to reflect on the vibrant tapestries woven into cultures around the world and the powerful stories clothing can tell. Until next time, goodbye.